I was born in Bethesda, Maryland, a D.C. suburb, and raised there.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
You know, I guess I don't know. I can't.
Okay. So when did you get interested? Getting interested in ideas and questions broader than what was going on in Bethesda, Maryland?
You know, I think probably when I was in college, mm-hmm. not in high school. I had other things. You know, I seemed to be interested in other things before I went to college.
And where did you go to college?
To Swarthmore College.
Mm-hmm. And what do you remember about your education there that was made the greatest impression, that really directed you into what you turned to, actually?
You know, I don't know. I mean, if I did learn one thing at college, you know, I did get an interest in ideas, you know, a passion for studying, which I didn't have, which a lot of the other students did have, and I didn't have. At the moment, though, still, I was interested in other things. You know, I was interested in relationships and sports.
Mm-hmm.
An intellectual life didn't seem to me like the most pressing matter at the time.
Mm-hmm. And this would have been what years, actually?
I entered in 78 mm-hmm. and was graduated in 83.
Mm-hmm. And what did you major in?
Engineering.
Engineering? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So a totally different vocation than you wound up doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
And what did you do after college? Did you go right to graduate school?
No. I went, you know, traveling with a friend at the time, went to find other friends. I started working as an engineer. It was then, actually, after being graduated from college that I began to learn the interests and the joy of political activity.
Mm-hmm.
Even in college, it seemed to me, I mean, all the political struggles on campus seemed to me moralistic and useless and a lot of posing.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, it was after that, early 80s, mid-80s, I suppose, when I got involved in political work that seemed much more important and useful and engaging, joyful.
And you were involved with the Central American crisis and the sanctuary work there. Tell us a little about that and how you got drawn into it.
How I got drawn into it, I guess, I mean, it's partly there was a friend who was, I did it with a friend, I guess. It seemed like it wasn't so much actually the people, the U.S.ers involved that interested me, it was the Central Americans that interested me.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the political sensibility of the other people from the U.S. also didn't agree with me, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
This friend and I went to Mexico City as a first as contact people for sanctuary, for sending people north, really. So we were working with the Quakers in Mexico City, choosing people to send them north to cross the border. It was then that I really got to know people who had been involved in political struggles in Guatemala and El Salvador. And then in El Salvador later that I learned it was a political initiation for me.
Mm-hmm. And what were you seeing, do you think, in was it the oppression that they were suffering, their ability to adapt to the
contrary. It was the pleasures and the sort of joyful life of political struggle.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean, you know, it was not, this is exactly what, let's put it this way, I think this is true in general, and still true today. There's sort of two kinds of political activists that you see, especially ones that go outside of the U.S. And this is North Americans and Europeans, I see this in both of them. There's the one kind that goes out of their guilt, and that is a kind of, we are privileged, we need to therefore sacrifice to help others who are less privileged, we need to pay for our being citizens of the oppressor nation, etc. Then there are the other ones, which are completely different, those first ones think that I'm giving something to them, and that's what I need to do is give something. The other one, which is much more like me, is I'm going because this is a better way to live. This is a much more joyful way, and they're giving something to me, not me giving something to them. I never really imagined that, and I think it was certainly true that in Nicaragua or El Salvador or Guatemala, we did really very much good for them.
Mm-hmm.
They did a lot of good for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this, like, what would we say? The one type, the defining emotion is shame or guilt, and for the other type, the defining emotion is joy and... politics is joy, something like that.
And what does the joy come from? That they're involved in a struggle, that they're active, that they're deciding and thinking about their own fate? Or is it all of those and more? All of those things?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that's, what do you say, the joys of a political life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, there's nothing particularly new in that. You can think of, a long tradition of that sort of thing. But I think that... there was something, it's not just my generation, but certainly my generation, which I felt was plagued by a kind of political moralism, which led to it's not exactly inaction, but I think a lot of misplaced action.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing that the Central Americans, of course, would say to all of us, and that was certainly true, but wasn't so clear how to address it at the time, which was, I remember once a group of Salvadoran students sitting me down at the National University and saying, look, it's really sweet that you're here and that you're trying to help and everything, but what would really do us the most good is if you went back to the U.S. and made revolution there. And it was right in the middle of the Reagan years at the time, and I thought, oh my God, they don't realize how hard that is. And there was a kind of, I think, self-exporting of, what would you call it? Political or even revolutionary desire among U.S. kids of my generation, where we saw there's nothing, felt like we couldn't do politics in the U.S. And so going to Nicaragua or going to El Salvador seemed like the solution. I think whatever these Salvadoran students telling me that they were exactly right. It's not, though, obviously it's not a very easy question to. Answer. It's not a very easy task to respond to.
Mm-hmm. When you were doing this work, were you doing a lot of reading about things that you didn't know about, or was it really just the political work?
There seemed at the time to me, and I guess I even wonder about this now, that a kind of disjunction between my intellectual life and my activist life. It's not that I wouldn't read about things going on and such, but the practical activist, militant questions seemed on a different register, and it was hard to connect them to scholarly issues. And sometimes still is. That's partly due to, what would we call it, a kind of anti-intellectualism in the U.S. activist circles. But not only that, it's also genuinely difficult to make the two connect.
Mm-hmm. Now, while you were doing this work, were you also practicing the vocation that you had at least initially assumed that is of an engineer?
Indirectly, for instance, this was 84, 85, and the National University in El Salvador had been occupied by the army in the early years of the 80s. And all of the equipment at the university had been taken by the army and sold. So when they reopened the university, they didn't have equipment. So for one thing, I started a program of collecting computers in the U.S., donations of computers through the church council so it could be tax deductible, and taking those computers to the engineering department at the University of El Salvador. I would get all these parts that didn't work, fix them up, mm-hmm. whatever, and take them down to the University of El Salvador. Which, whatever, I wasn't making brilliant use, I suppose, of my education, but it was related and seemed like...
And practical, it sounds.
It seemed like a way I could be helpful, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's what...
Was it during this period that you actually studied or went to work in France, actually? I think I saw somewhere that you were actually working for a solar energy company, or...
I did my work as an engineer for a solar energy company, first in the U.S. and then in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Before that.
Before
yeah.
That, okay. But then, was it this political experience that led you to want to go get your graduate degree, or were you already getting your graduate degree? I'm trying to.
I was already doing this by, let's say, 86 or something, 85. I started as in comparative literature, which again, I didn't see any direct connection between the two. Vaguely, I guess I thought in the early, when I was an undergraduate, that engineering, or to say appropriate technology for the third world, etc., could be a political choice. It seemed like the kind of theorizing, kind of philosophical work that was allowed to be done in comparative literature programs sometimes seemed related to the political things. But like I say, it's very difficult to make all these things match up.
So what, but I get the sense in what I've read about you and from your work that you were drawn to interdisciplinary studies. I mean, that you wanted to see beyond the confines of any narrow discipline.
I think really only later. As much as anyone's drawn out of a kind of intellectual curiosity, I suppose, but... it's only really later, maybe finishing a doctorate and doing other sorts of intellectual work that at least I'd be able to thematize what the need for interdisciplinary work. That was only something that really comes with a kind of intellectual maturity, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do your dissertation on?
The dissertation in the U.S. I did on Gilles Deleuze, a French philosopher, and on Italian politics in the 60s and 70s. Sort of two halves, thinking that the two had some relation to one another.
And so I guess in through this education and this odyssey, you had acquired language skills. I always like to emphasize that in these interviews, because that seems to be really an important way to prepare for the future. So you had Italian and French under your belt, or acquired?
In Spanish, a certain amount, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. When did you meet Antonio Negri, and when did your collaboration really begin?
It's right in these years. In a way, it was, at least in retrospect, I tell myself this story. I think it's more or less true that I was frustrated with the whole paradigm of U.S., young people working in Central America. I felt like it wasn't our political struggle. It was theirs. We were merely observers. We were mostly in the way, and it really didn't relate to our politics.
Their struggle.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it seemed to me that reading about, especially Italian political movements in the 70s. This was in the mid 80s now, but. In the 70s seemed to relate, and so reading Tony Negri's work was part of this whole, we'll say, political intellectual milieu. So it was partly by that kind of hope or inspiration that I thought meeting him would, and even, you know, working with him, even like being a student of his, although it didn't turn out to be a student of his, I thought that would be a way of addressing these political and intellectual concerns, making them match up. And also that the Italian struggle seemed to have more to do with us in the U.S. than the Salvadorans did, however inspirational and the Salvadorans were.
And why is that? Was it because they were addressing these radical political questions in the context of the modernization of the Italian economy and modern life, that they were kind of a latecomer to this new wave of modernization that was affecting Europe?
I suppose so. The Italian social problems and possibilities of political activity had a lot more to do with us than the Salvadorans did. I remember posing. There was a close friend who had come north, a Guatemalan who had, you know, been in the mountains for several years with the guerrillas and had come with the Underground Railroad to Seattle, where I was at the time. And I was saying to him the frustration. He says, look, you have mountains here. Just go to the mountains. That's what we do. We go to the mountains. I thought, okay. We had mountains around Seattle, but that wasn't what was...
It's a big metaphor, though, actually. You know, we go to the mountains with mountain bikes, right?
Right. It wasn't, you know, there wasn't a way of making comparable questions. I mean, even Italy in the 70s, there was actually quite different social atmosphere that of course couldn't be replicated, but it was much closer. I mean, there were kind of urban struggles that had to do, you know, not only with questions of transformation of labor, gender struggles, unemployment. It was much closer to the possibilities of struggle in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And that's something that seemed to me, worth pursuing. Or it seemed to me an open avenue. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I sought out Tony. In fact, I translated a book of his in order to meet him, because he at the time was not exactly clandestine, but was very difficult to meet, actually.
We should tell our audience exactly, could you give us a nutshell profile?
Version.
Yeah, the short version of who he was. But, I mean, I can say initially that he was a political theorist, but also an activist, an intellectual leader of the autonomy movement in Italy, and very much involved in thinking about radical politics in Italy. But
right.
Is there something else that you would add to that that's not...
Sure. Let me try to give the short version of it. It's a sort of a Hollywood-like story. I hope that I get it all right, too. You know, so he was a leader in student worker movements in the 60s in Italy, in the 60s through the 70s. The first of a group that was, in fact, quite centralized from the late 60s to early 70s, called Potere Operaio, Workers' Power. And then that transformed into a very... loose-knit network of organizations called, as you said, Autonomy, or Workers' Autonomy, through the mid-70s. These were also the same years when, parallel to these, let's say, non-terrorist groups that he was involved in, but groups nonetheless in which the violence occurred at demonstrations, etc., parallel to that arose the various terrorist groups in Italy, first of all the Red Brigades, but various other groups too. By the end of the 70s, after Aldo Moro was murdered by the Red Brigades, there were in place emergency laws in Italy from the perspective of the Italian state, to combat terrorism, but it was a very broad net for, in a way, reining in all forces of the left. You might think of that the same approach of counterterrorism in Southeast Asia, that if you take away the water, the fish will die, kind of thing. So anyway, Tony was part of the water. That's the way you think about it. He was arrested in 1979 under these emergency laws, whereby he could be held for 2 years without being charged and 4 years without coming to trial. So during these first 2 years, there were all kinds of reports in the media. Magistrates said all kinds of things with which he was never charged. But the most, dramatic of those was that he was responsible for Aldo Moro's killing, the secret leader of the Red Brigades, and in fact the mastermind of all terrorism in Europe. You can imagine all kinds of amplifications. He was, of course, never tried for that, and it was quite clear that he was never involved in the Red Brigades. I think that's been quite... I mean, the judges, everyone was quite clear about that. When he finally came to trial, let's see, four years hence. What he was tried of, though, were, he was tried under these strange laws that are a bit like RICO, I suppose. They call them moral responsibility in Italy, which is that if you can prove someone's the leader of a group, he or she can be held responsible for everything committed by members of that group. So the judges tried to prove that he was the leader of this loose-knit network called Autonomia, based on his writings. Very strange trial, dragging out his books, you know, very erudite books, etc. And some of them inflammatory pamphlets, too. In any case, while he's being tried, he was elected to parliament by the Radical Party as a kind of protest against these 2,000 people in prison under these emergency laws. You might be getting dizzy already with the holidays. So. He's elected to parliament, but under the Italian law, you couldn't hold a member of parliament in jail for a political crime. He had to be released. Mm-hmm. After 2 months, the parliament votes to rescind his immunity, at which time he escapes on a sailboat to France. He goes to Elba first. It's all very dramatic. Mm-hmm. And France, the Mitterrand government at the time, refuses to recognize the extradition request from Italy. And so he spent 14 years in exile mm-hmm. in France, mm-hmm. convicted in absentia while he's gone. And so that's when I met him there in France, a couple of years after he arrived.
And to finish his story, we're going to go back to your collaboration in a minute. He ultimately returned to Italy and was given a sentence, and he's presently in a kind of a house arrest.
Is that he's now actually even finished that. Yeah. He was returned in 1997, did 2 years all the time, what do you call it, fixed in prison, 2 years of work release, out a day and a night, 2 years of house arrest, and now finally he's gotten his complete release with passport and everything. Mm-hmm. Happy end of story.
So Al, let's move to this collaboration. The two of you wrote a book called Empire, which is published by the Harvard University Press, and which has become a kind of does one say a book is an intellectual bestseller? I guess that's the way you say it. And it's been translated into 22 languages, I think you told me, actually. So I guess the before we start talking about the book, and I want to talk you through some of the central ideas, why do you think the book had such an impact? Impact in the sense of beyond sales, but a book that people either agree or disagree with very strongly.
You know, one never knows these things, but one idea I have is that the book, this is what I've thought, that the book is not terribly original. And I mean that in a good way. I don't mean that as any kind of modesty. I think that, like, truly original books don't get read. Truly original books, you know, no one can understand. These are, in fact, what we're saying is something that is not exactly obvious, but is, but people are already thinking. And so that it's being formulated coherently, or relatively coherently, best we can do, mm-hmm. Is what, and I assume that's what happens. Now I'm not just talking about our book, but books in general that have a certain kind of intellectual success. They're books that people are ready for. Mm-hmm. Another thing that that I assume has this sort of effect is that, and this comes back to what you were saying earlier about interdisciplinarity. I mean, on one hand, we think that one can't address the kind of problem we're trying to address in this book, global power structures, etc., from a single discipline. Like, if you look at it only from an economic perspective, you'll get a very partial view. From a political perspective, cultural, etc. In fact, that might be a little bit like that. Was that story about the blind men and the elephant? Mm-hmm. You know, if you have these very, and so if you put the various ones together. I think that's how the blind man and the elephant story goes. If you put the various ones together, yeah. You can actually get the picture of the whole. On the other hand, what happens at the same time in that is that we work with, in the book, and in our work in general, I guess, recognitions in a variety of fields that don't usually coordinate with each other, but that we try to bring into interrelationship with each other and show, in a way, how they can profit from each other. Mm-hmm. For instance, here's just a for instance. I mean, this is one way to summarize the book in ways that we recognize in a variety of fields, or in a variety of different social fields, but also in a variety of different disciplines. There are a variety of theories of a kind of historical transition that happened, let's say, between 1968 and 1973, or maybe between 68 and 1989, et cetera. Like in international relations, one might talk about the end of colonial regimes and the development of a post-colonial world order. In economic terms, one talks about the shift in labor practices from labor in the dominant countries focused on the factory towards a post-industrial, let's say, society. in terms of economic terms, again, about regimes of accumulation, there's a shift, modernism to postmodernism and cultural theory. And so by taking these various shifts that, in fact, actually coincide more or less historically, lining them all up together, mm-hmm. we try to propose a sort of much more developed paradigm shift. And that's really what the book is about this shift that in fact is coordinated in economic, political, economic, political, cultural, social terms, mm-hmm. in a way they unevenly mesh together, and one can see how we've entered a new era in the terms of it by looking at it simultaneously from these various perspectives.
Now, how then did you do this collaboration? We'll get to the ideas in a minute. Did each of you write different parts? Did you each struggle with the other's parts? Did you constant rewrites? Give us a sense, because as you've just suggested, it's a comprehensive work covering many disciplines, and building on two very different experiences of the two authors, actually, in some ways.
Yeah, that's in fact one of the fun things about collaborating, is that we, you know, part of the process is giving each other reading lists or giving each other books, mm-hmm. and so becoming expert in the specializations of the other person. I mean, he's constantly giving me things to read about German legal thought. And I like it, you know, and I love it and everything, but that's his primary training was in legal theory or state theory, as they mm-hmm. call it in Italy. And particularly in Italy, German legal thought of the early 20th century was key, and so that, in ways, a lot of my training in our collaboration. On the other hand, you know, what's called post-colonial studies, various notions about multicultural notions that are very common in the U.S. In France and Italy, both are very new, and so having him read things about you know, race studies in the U.S., about post-coloniality or post-colonial theory in general, these are things that are completely new to him. So part of it goes that way. But the material process you asked about, what we do is, this is our common, the way we do things. First we sit down at a table together and make outlines. Often that goes on for a long time, you know, very detailed outlines. Then we do split up and make first drafts of specific parts. He writes in Italian, I write in English, and then we switch and rewrite each other's things. I translate it into English when I rewrite his Italian. He, since he still works on a manual typewriter, cuts up my pieces, adds them in the middle. Mm-hmm. And then we often go again, so that finally it ends up in English, but in the end we generally can't tell who wrote what, and or even who had which idea. There's a kind of, you know, back and forth that makes it, it's interesting that there's also something interesting about the writing, I find. I think this is true with anyone that writes collaboratively. When we write together, when we're writing something together, even when I'm drafting something or he's drafting something, I kind of write in his voice, and he writes thinking mm-hmm. he's in my voice. But I think that neither of us actually really do that. I think both of us kind of write in a third voice, which is neither one of us.
Or at least it comes out in a third voice.
It comes out, and that's what I mean. A third voice, which is strange voice. It's not, you know, mine. It's full of exclamation points and enthusiasm and.
Mm-hmm. And what are his languages besides Italian?
French.
French. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, he reads German and English easily, but he's. Yeah.
Now I'm gonna have you talk about Empire in 1 minute. What exactly it is, but one final question here along this line, and that is, when was the book written? Exactly. I mean, it's obviously, but there are two historical markers here, right? Uh-huh. The Gulf War and the Kosovo War. Between that period, is that what I think I read?
Right. We did write that in the preface. Right. We got the idea actually watching the first Gulf mm-hmm. War on TV, saying to each other, you know, that this is something different. Mm-hmm. That's really what, and that we needed to. You know, come to find a way to account for it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I guess, I mean, I assume we wrote it through the early 90s, although he went back he left France and went back to prison in Italy in the summer of 97, at which point I finished the book for another year, I suppose. And so we turned it into the press in 98. It came out in 2000.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is empire? And I jotted down these notes, and I'll have you respond to that. But in a way, it's a structure, it's an opportunity, and it's an emerging condition. Those are the three things. But within, am I right? And then really give us a definition, because empire does not have, or it does not connote what it normally connotes when we talk about empire today. What is it for you?
Yeah. I mean, it's probably not a good term. We just couldn't come up with any other one.
For book sales, it might be a very good term. But
might have been. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, what we wanted to say, this is what we were, our initial mandate, really, is to say that we think that that imperialism, as it was practiced essentially mostly by the European powers through, let's say, from the 18th to the 20th century, is no longer the adequate model of global domination, as it had been practiced, and that in fact there was emerging a new form of global power, of global domination. Now, and so therefore, let's see. Insofar as imperialism is essentially founded on the structures of national sovereignty. In other words, the imposition of a national sovereignty over foreign territories, the imposition of British sovereignty over its colonial and also its non-colonial territories, or French or German, or also the U.S. sovereignty in its imperialist formations. The idea is that in fact it's not founded on the nation state, that we're entering an age when national sovereignty cannot suffice for globalizing projects. And there has to be instead, and this is what we mean by empire, essentially a network of powers that function collaboratively. It's not, of course, that nation states are no longer important. Nation states are important, some obviously more than others. We're thinking of empire as a network of, let's say, national powers, but also economic powers, supranational organizations, even non-governmental organizations, that this decentered network structure is the emerging form of global order today, and that it's something in fact different than imperialism as we previously knew it. You know, I think...
No, please, go ahead.
Well, I was thinking that it might be useful to start directly with a post 9/11, although the book's written before 9/11, there's an immediate, I think, post 9/11 question that comes to anyone's mind when one says something like this, which is, well, that might have been true in the Clinton years in the 90s, but now with Bush and his war on terrorism, post 9/11, etc., what we have is imperialism in the old style. You know, we have a U.S. imperialism, invade and occupy Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. Our hypothesis, and it seems, you know, I'm stubborn, of course, I still manage to believe things no matter what. Our hypothesis is that, in fact, that's not true. Like, that it's not true today that the U.S. can act as an imperialist power in the way that imperialist powers have previously. In other words, to use the more recent terms for these things, that the U.S. cannot succeed in a unilateralist project of global reshaping or global domination, if you like. So that, right, let me give you what seemed to me an amusing proposition I heard a year ago from Tariq Ali, who the editor of New Left Review, a good friend. And a guest on the program. Good, I can believe you. Good listen for that segment. Tariq said a year ago, he said, look, what Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Bush, etc., what they're doing is they're trying to prove empire wrong, like prove our book wrong, prove the idea or hypothesis wrong. Prove it wrong precisely by reinvigorating the old kind of imperialism, unilateralist national control over other territories. Now, you know, he said that more or less at the time of the, what we call the victory of Baghdad, you know, a year ago. Well, you know, a year later, it doesn't look so hot. The unilateralist...
That is trying to bring the old imperialism back.
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, so our, what would, you know, if one were going to work with, you know, does our, what our hypothesis would say about such matters is that the only effective and long-lasting means of today constructing a global power structure or a global form of control will be along the model that we suggest in empire, and that these say resurrected imperialist notions are doomed to failure, to continual instability, etc. It doesn't mean, of course, that we want the one or the other. It's an hypothesis about the structure, the emerging structures of power.
Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, and you both are coming from the left. Is it fair to say that you come out of the Marxist slash communist tradition, or is that an unfair?
No, no, that's fine.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. And so, coming out of that tradition, and trying to find these new power structures and their tendencies and their possibilities for progressive causes, you have been accused in that context of wholeheartedly embracing globalization, of seeing it, that is this, because what you're saying is a network world across areas,
right,
not just economics, but culture and so on, that this network world, which we'll put under the rubric of globalization,
right,
is something that should be looked at in a different way. That to see what is and to say there are alternative forms of globalization.
Right.
Explain that. Am I right about that? And is your attitude more positive toward what globalization is and might be than is the case traditionally with the left?
I think it's probably fair to say obviously globalization is a horrible term in the sense that it encompasses all kinds of things. It's used very widely and vaguely. I think that one can certainly be against the contemporary forms of globalization, if by that we mean the control of multinational corporations, the invalidation of labor and ecological laws, etc. But if one means by globalization a kind of free movement of peoples and a global movement of liberation, then of course that's long been the project probably of the left generally, but certainly of the, as you put it, communist and Marxist left. I think what one has to do, I mean, this is what, let me back up a minute, this seems easier. I mean, the so-called anti-globalization movements, it seems to me that the vast majority of those involved in these movements are in fact not anti-globalization in the least. They're really the pro-globalization movements. I would say in fact that the so-called proponents of globalization, those of them at The Economist and in the White House, are the ones who are really anti-globalization. What we are, because the movements are themselves globalizing, of course. I mean, even if we insist on local issues, we're doing it in a way that coordinates with those in other countries and other places and recognizes the consequences. But in a way, we're, let's say, I would say something like that it would be impossible, I suppose, to imagine new democratic structures without having a global vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to me, in fact, the end goal of these globalization movements.
Mm-hmm. Now, and when you say that the establishment, the White House, the people who run the American economy are in a way anti-globalization, by that you mean that their strategies and plans work against the democratic and progressive possibilities of globalization.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Right.
Now, within the left, there has been a search for, throughout history, the possibilities of internationalism. In recent times, there has been an interest in local struggles and the importance of those struggles. But somehow, you comment on this in your book, there hasn't been a linkage of discrete local struggles in Chiapas, in LA, or wherever, across international borders. And why is that, and what are the possibilities for turning your insights into a political program?
Well, I think that one has to look and see what those local struggles. I guess one shouldn't, for one thing, think that there's an alternative between local struggles concerned with immediate needs and global or transnational or distant links. There has to be, in fact, a way of pursuing both at the same time, and usually there is. When we were writing this in the middle 90s and recognizing the difficulty of linking up whatever labor struggles in Paris in 1995 or in South Korea or the Zapatista movement and the LA riots, these things seemed to us at the time to be, let's say, discrete and not linking together in a kind of either cycle of struggles or common movement. Since then, there have in fact been many, many developments in that direction. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there was a kind of recognition of things that were already happening in Seattle in 1999. The various world social forums and regional social forums have also been that kind of, let's say, bringing into connection, mm-hmm. You know, not making the same, of course, but bringing into connection a variety of different local and regional struggles. And then, of course, February 15th last year, the great, you know, the great day of global demonstrations against the war, February 15th in 2003, was exactly this kind of demonstration of a, let's say, global reach and commonality of struggles. And the war itself, I mean, the imminent then war against Iraq, proposed a common occasion, but it's the kind of thing, of course, that can be that we will see in the future years developed even further.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious because one of the criticisms of the book that I've encountered in the readings is that your book does not answer the question what is to be done, so mm-hmm. to speak, and. We have talked here in this hour about your own thoughts about being involved as you were involved mm-hmm. in political activism, and you were sort of suggesting a separation between theory and action at different points of your career. But I want to address that question directly and see if I've misunderstood you. What generally do you think is the relation between theorizing and political activity? Are they two separate compartments that both need to be done, two sets of activities that both need to be done, or do they inform each other, and how do they inform each other?
Well, first, I wouldn't make the distinction between theory and practice. I'd make the distinction, first off, between theorizing in different contexts. In other words, like, for instance, when we, you know, Tony and I don't want to write what is to be done, because it seems to us quite inappropriate for the two of us in a philosophical register to try to propose the course of action. That's not the right way to do it. We're not the right ones to do it, but no one, in fact, in that position is in the right place to do it. Where that should be done is collectively in movements, and that's where I think it is done. I think that there's movements aren't just about practice. There's a kind of theorizing that goes on in movements. And in many ways, we see our own, let's say, philosophical work as existing in parallel with the kind of theorizing that's going on in the movements. You know, there's a great intelligence one has to read often. You know, it's not that the movements also have their own, you know, whatever, philosophical organs. It's not like you can go to one person and say, what do the movements think? The movements think in a different way. They think in a way that has to, I think, that has to be interpreted, but is nonetheless clear and, like I say, intelligent. So that's the distinction I would make between a kind of what I'm calling philosophical. I don't know if that's the right word for it. Kind of reflections, which I think are useful. I don't think our work is not useful, but it's not the place to make practical proposals. It's not the place to make program. And then there's theorizing done collectively in the movements, which I think is the place to, and it's the place that it's already done. It's the place that it's done all the time, and that's what seems to me the appropriate division. And then one can do both. I mean, I don't feel one should have, I suppose, different sides of one's own intellectual life.
Mm-hmm. And you earlier you said that you didn't see this work as something other than putting together a lot of theorizing and information that was out there across disciplines in a way and across spheres of
activity. Partly that, yeah, and saying things that people are already thinking, maybe if they don't even know they're thinking it. Like, for instance, Sears seems to me an example of what I was just talking about. The let's think before September 11th, the trajectory of these North American and European movements around globalization. It seems to me that they had more or less the same idea of empire we did. And why do I say that? Because if they thought that the U.S. was, and the White House, that the U.S. state, the U.S. government, was the one who was directly responsible for all the problems of domination in the world, well, they should have been protesting at the White House every week. But instead, they were kind of, I think that they had recognized that there was, in a way, a new power structure and new enemies, and they were experimenting with possible enemies. Well, let's try the G8. Let's try the World Bank and the IMF. Let's try the WTO. In a way, all of those, let's say, experimentations were inadequate, but there was a kind of working with, piecing together this network of powers that were in fact, you know, forming the new power structure. And I think it's the same, that's why I was saying, so it's not terribly original. We wrote in 1998 what they were, you know, enacting in 1999. It's not like they read our book and decided to do this, or we just saw what was happening and wrote the book. It's all grappling with our present condition. And I think a bit, I mean, when I say this also about this not being terribly original, it's not with any modesty. It's more of a recognition of how books are, how intellectual activity happens. We think things in a sort of common fabric, and that's the way it works.
What other thing that stands out in the book, which is its lack of extreme criticism of the United States. I guess that's the euphemistic way to put it. And that you, and again, you do make the distinction between American imperialism and the implications of the order that America has set into play.
Right.
For example, following up on what you just said, the U.S. was very important in creating a lot of the international institutions that now become the local of locus of protest and so on. It's surprising in a way that an Italian radical philosopher and activist and you would together coin a book which has in some ways a sophisticated analysis of both the pluses and the minuses of U.S. power. Talk a little about that. Am I right in that assessment, or am I making you more pro-American than you are?
No, I don't really see the need for this alternative of either being anti-American or pro-American. It doesn't seem to me a rational, whatever kind of division that's imposed on things. I mean, our simple point, let's see, the initial point is this, that if you want to understand the nature, particularly thinking strictly of the notion of sovereignty that has emerged in this new global structure, one can't look at the model of sovereignty developed within the modern European nation states, which in fact was the basis for imperialist projects, a kind of a notion of sovereignty based on closed boundaries, on a kind of dialectic of pure identities of self and other outside the metropole and colony, etc. One can much better understand the kind of global sovereignty that's emerging today by looking at the U.S. constitutional tradition, which involves at least an ideology and in some places a fact of open boundaries, open in the notion of expansive boundaries, and a kind of indifference between inside and outside, a continual, inclusion of the outside. And probably consequently a notion of hybrid identities, which isn't just based on purity. This seems to us not that it's better or worse than the other one, but a much better model, better in the sense of it fits analytically with what the emerging global system is. Once again, this is not a matter of actually singing the praises at this moment of the U.S. tradition. It's a matter of recognizing a different form that in fact coincides. We call this imperial and link it to empire in large part because it corresponds in certain ways to Rome, to ancient Rome. Of course, the early U.S. Founders were very interested in Rome precisely in these regards. There's a way in which Rome and the Roman notion of sovereignty similarly had a kind of inclusion of external populations, hybrid identities within Rome, expansive open boundaries, that sort of thing. It's something, I mean, this was to be, this the U.S. founders love to say, this was to be a new Rome and a new Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. But they certainly had that in mind. In any case, that's one aspect of it, is that the U.S. history, and particularly U.S. constitutional history, seemed to us a better model for understanding what's going on now. The other aspect, though, is that there are wonderful things, there are wonderful liberatory things within the U.S. tradition. I mean, one of course has to condemn all kinds of things throughout U.S. history, but also recognize others. I think that there's a kind of, blackmail that goes on. Often on the left, both in the U.S. and outside, on this count, which just seems to me self-defeating.
Now, what do you mean by that? Explain what you mean.
I mean that one has to either be even just with the way that you posed the question to me before, which I don't mean as you. I think it's the common way of posing it, which is that the fact of our not being, of our not, what would you say? Condemning the U.S. categorically makes us apologists for the United States, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of my friends and colleagues says something like that the first duty of a U.S. intellectual is to be anti-American. I think, I guess I disagree. I mean, not that I mean one should apologize for all the horrible things the U.S. government has done. I don't mean that at all. But I mean that one should recognize those and recuperate the strains within U.S. history and also within French history and also within English history that in fact are the basis for future struggles. That's what I mean by blackmail.
Yeah. In the book somewhere you comment on the Gulf War, the first Gulf War,
right,
as an instance in which there were clearly American interests involved in stopping Iraq's aggression into Kuwait, but on the other hand, in the way the United States mobilized support for that operation, built a coalition, and the arguments it used were in a way moving beyond its own interest and pointing in the direction of this world of empire as opposed to the world of imperial power. So it's really, in a way, what you're saying is there are pieces in American history, in American law, that transcend what its leaders at a particular time might choose to do. That is imperial action, which some might say is what happened in the second Iraq War. So there's always a potential, I guess, in some, which transcends what may be the narrow interest or intention of U.S. leaders.
I think that it's true that today U.S. leaders are constrained and will fail when they try to act as an imperialist power. I mean, I think that's definitely true, and that they will only succeed in so that they're, I mean, the forces of circumstances, this would be the argument, make it so that they can only succeed by not in acting in the interests, in the universal interest, in the interest of everyone, but acting in the interests of a much broader source of, let's say, foundation of global power. I don't mean to suggest, though, that in any way that these imperial regimes, that our new global power structure is less brutal, less cruel than imperialist regimes. On the contrary, in many ways, it's more cruel and more brutal. The differences of poverty in the world are more brutal. And there are many ways in which exploitation is greater in economic terms, in which political oppression is greater. I mean, the first argument is that it's different, and one has to recognize the difference in order then to combat it.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us today for this conversation and this really interesting story of your odyssey and your thoughts on your book. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.